America and the Global South, much more needs to happen because we have a counter power. You know, for instance, IMF has agreements with the countries like Ecuador, where I'm from, where, you know, it's impulsing neoliberal policies. For instance, in Ecuador, in 2020, we saw a 10% budget cut in the health sector. You would think that this is ridiculous in the middle of a pandemic, but that's the type of policy that we're seeing in some of the countries. So to have progressive governments coupled with progressive leaderships around the world to say we can and we will strengthen our health sovereignty, our capacity to attend our own needs, because health, we have seen it been used as a weapon. This is not only a matter of money. Now, a lot of countries have had contracts signed, payments to pharmaceutical companies.
We have to leave it there, but I want to thank you so much for being with us, Corinna Vance and Achal Prabala. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned natural foods cooperative featuring farm-direct organic produce from more than 30 local farms, bulk foods, and a farmer's market every Wednesday year-round. Located at Southeast Tibbet Street and 21st Avenue in Portland for almost 50 years. Online at peoples.coop.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8 a.m., it's Monday. It's time for more talk radio with your hosts, Celeste Carey and Cecil Prescott. Stay tuned.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You are listening to your community connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city, 91.9 along the Columbia River Gorge in Whitestone, Washington, Hood River, Oregon, and points south like Philomath, Oregon. It is 104.3, and everywhere it is KBOO.FM. And it's going to be a bright, sunny morning today. Like, stay cool as you can. Stay cool as a cucumber. Listen to KBOO. And what is it to say? Chill. So I guess instead of that movie channel and chill, it would be KBOO and chill.
KBOO. Well, huh. Okay.
Yeah.
But we want to keep it clean and above all, so above, never mind. I'll just leave it alone.
Because you boggled me. I go, what?
when you say, you know, that streaming service and chill, it means something.
Yeah, but it also meant just stay in and watch the TV. Look, watch this segue. Check this out. Speaking of chill, KBOO dropped a really hot t-shirt. It's our soul and hip-hop t-shirt. We dropped it down for what I've been calling it, KBOO Soul Summer in the City. That's what I've been calling this summer. Okay.
Uh-huh.
So the t-shirt is hot. Y'all got to check it out. You got to get one. And there's somebody that said, you know, something kind of disparaging about the T-shirt, like they didn't like the color and it's too small and cut too short. And it's like, that ain't true, because the T-shirt has not shipped out yet. Okay, so don't believe that. You know, here's the deal. I ordered mine. Some other folks has ordered theirs. They like it. It's soulful. You got to check it out. Got the sister on there with the supernatural.
And all right.
Speaking vibrations are hot wax. Yes, she is. You have to check it out. Well, how can I do that, Celeste? You can go to kboo.fm/gift, or you can just go to the KBOO website, and when you see that pop up there, you can order the T-shirt. And it is. I can't wait till mine comes. It's going to drop, I think. Let's see, what's the day? Today's the 21st, first day of summer. I think it's going to drop in at the end of June or early July. So we'll still have it in plenty of time to be, you know, repping our cable.
Hot fun in the summertime. Yes, indeed.
You know. I only thought about it for a while. Cool.
It's already over 70 degrees here in Portlandia, so, and it's bright and sunny. So, yeah, it feels like summer.
It is. Technically, it's the first day of summer, so it's right on point.
Okay. Well, you know, talking of that, we should celebrate the first day of summer. This is the month of June. What else is happening in June? This weekend, there was a whole slew of things to celebrate. There was Juneteenth.
Mm-hmm. I got mixed up with that. But yeah.
Yeah. It was Father's Day.
All right.
You mentioned to me earlier that June was Black Music Month.
Yep.
People, the end of school, graduations.
Pride Month. Just a host of things going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it made for a really busy weekend. People were out doing their thing, which meant that other people had to be out working so that people could do their thing.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, what's really interesting is that we, you know, we're looking at all this and we're looking at all the lines of people and celebrating the fact that it seems like, even though there's lines of people out there, it means things are getting back to whatever normal is. But it's kind of deceptive, isn't it? You know, because even while we're trying to celebrate getting back to normal, one of the biggest things that I see that's a change is that so many people are not so sure they want to get back into the employment swing of things normal. I noticed every place I went, they had a sign up that said, "We're hiring." And I was standing outside a Burger Doodle chain, no less, and they were offering over $16 an hour for Burger Doodle workers to come in and work for them, please. And I noticed signs at my grocery store, at my drugstore, you know, at the hardware store, just all the places, come work for us. But it seems like, despite all this, you know, summer in the city and, you know, hot fun in the summertime and how that means you get out and celebrate and recreate, there has to be somebody there who is working to help you do that. Well, people don't want to come back to work. They don't.
Certainly. And just a couple of observations. You mentioned that this burger place was offering employment of $16 an hour, and I think, you know, that might sound, wow, they're offering a lot of money, but $16 an hour will not, in this market where we are, if you working full time for $16 an hour will not afford you a one bedroom apartment in the Portland area. It's something like over $20 a month of $20 an hour you need to afford a one-bedroom apartment. So that's just a reality check. And speaking also about, you know, people not going to work, you know, there's been a slew of articles, news report about that. And one that I came across was by Derek Thompson in the Atlantic magazine, who writes that somewhat starts off like you began, Celeste. He writes, quitting your job is hot this summer. More Americans quit in May than any other month on record, going back to the beginning of this century. For every 100 workers in hotel, restaurants, bars, and retailers, about 5 of them quit last month. And it is not only low-wage workers who are looking at the job with one eye on the door. It made more than 700,000 in the mostly white-collar categories of professional and business services left their jobs. Highest monthly number ever. And all across the sectors, 4 in 10 employees now say they are considering piecing out their current place of work. So the question is, why is there a sudden burst of quitting? One theory is that we're living through a fundamental shift in the relationship between employees and bosses that could have profound implications for the future of work. Up and down the income ladder, workers have new reasons to quit their jobs. Lower wage workers are benefiting from enhanced unemployment benefits that we've mentioned in the past and might want to also talk about today. Enhanced unemployment benefits that may have returned to the job and realized they're not being paid enough. Now they put in their foot to the door and leaving. And meanwhile, you know, white collar workers are quitting. Many feels overworked and generally burned out during this pandemic year. We can talk about how people have experienced work this past year, and the realization that maybe what they have been doing is not worth it. You know, so why are people quitting? And quitting gets a bad rap in life, but is that necessarily so? Maybe this summer of quitting augurs, Mr. Thompson writes, a bigger, a new golden age, not only for workers' power, but all of in terms of productivity growth. And they has this observation. He writes, think about the last time you went to a restaurant. Celeste, you mentioned that. If your experience was anything like mine, he writes, you scan a QR code to order rather than chatting with a server. The restaurant serves you a typical meal despite having a smaller staff than usual. Multiply that across the economy, you have better paid employees working in concert with software to more efficiently serve customer. Things are changing. I noticed I went to a restaurant this past week, and you know, there was someone who showed us to our table, but you know, they mentioned, do you want a menu, or do you want a paper menu, or do you just want to scan the QR code? And things are changing. So what do we make of all of this? Our engineer mentioned that, you know, jobs are notoriously abusive. And
yes.
And well,
you know,
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, here is an interesting thing, though, with this new service system, and this is specifically for, you know, hospitality. But I went out a couple of weeks ago. A friend of mine manages a place downtown, and we went out, and I asked for a menu, and you had to have a QR code reader because, again, paperless. Well, see, my phone won't read QR codes unless I download the app again. And I took the app off so I could do stuff more relevant to my work, and my phone's full. So, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to make it read, and I'm just thinking, you know what? This would make me want to go to a different place because I'm stuck because I can't access a menu just to see what they have to offer. So there's technological phasing out of consumers at the same time they're trying to lure in workers. And, you know, I'm just looking at this whole situation, and I'm thinking, okay, how long is this sustainable? And, you know, I'm watching my friends who work in the service industry say I'm not sure if I'm going back to work or not at this job because I need to find out what's going to make me feel good. I can't do this. It's not about sitting here and collecting unemployment, even though this person is collecting unemployment right now and helping out their elderly mom. You know, I get to thinking, how are we going to sustain this current dynamic? What's going to be the end result? We have high wages being paid because you have a small pool of willing workers. When we get back to work, will these wages remain or will they cut these wages? Because, you know, some states are cutting unemployment. So they're trying to force workers back. And if they can't force workers back, what's going to happen? We are looking at the possibility of inflation, though, depending on, you know, which outlets you use, you might read that with lumber prices coming down, inflation might be losing its sting. You read that wages might be going up, but who's to say they're going to stay up once they get no more unemployment being paid and they get a decent pool of workers, you know, the workforce is back. So, you know, we want to talk to people. You know, some time ago we talked about how folks not wanting to return to work was affecting those who were still at work, and especially in hospitality and medical care and such, because those were two of the hard hit industries where people were not coming back to work. Now the question is, how are we going to sustain it? Are we, you know, for those who are getting these higher wages as they go back, do they think they'll be sustained? And just what are your thoughts on this? It's a broad topic for sure. We'll try to keep it corralled, but we welcome your call here on More Talk Radio. We welcome your call at 503-231-8187. And you get a chance to join in conversation here on More Talk Radio with Cecil and myself, Celeste, on your community connection, KBOO, Portland.
You know, one thing that occurred, you talk about how things are changing and how people have a new, different attitude. I think one thing we must realize that Derek Thompson mentions in his article, that the fact that the pandemic killed 600,000 people, and that led to a paradigm shift in workers' power. And you know, when major crises happen, it impacts the economy. Derek Thompson writes that the Great Chicago Fire of 1871 contributed to the invention of the modern skyscraper. The East Coast Blizzard of 1888 led to the first American subway system. Who can foresee how our response to this disaster might change the world in ways that was hard to forecast before it happened? A revolution might be happening, or it may be an illusion. The overall annual quit total plunge in 2020 by about 500,000 people, suggesting that a lot of people who would have quit without the pandemic instead clung to their jobs they didn't like. That the number of people quitting a job is surging now isn't necessarily proof of a shift in the paradigm. It's more like evidence of an unpinched hose effect. The pandemic constrained all sorts of normal activities, getting a cocktail, renting a car, leaving a crappy job. That all suddenly unblocked. So what is our politicians doing about it? Derek Thompson writes that the White House seemed to see this dynamic clearly. A blog post from the Council of Economic Advisor recently cautioned that economic data may look berserk this summer. A number of commentators are warning against drawing big conclusions about the future. A whole lot of this might be a mirage, Adam Oyemek writes. And he writes that the White House is a lot more realistic than the median liberal pundit right now. So we may not know what's happening. All of it is just a large guessing game, I suppose. But how do we reconcile these two things, the awesome potential of the moment and the fact that its awesomeness might be predicated on a mirage? Derek Thompson writes, maybe the answer is just keep doing what you're doing. Policymakers should act as if the labor market has room to run, because it does. And employers, while seeking out new complementary technology, the QR code and all, should pay their workforce more because they can. And that's fundamentally, if you pay people, people will come.
Well, yeah, and that sums it up. But we want to talk with you, and not just Cecil and I talk among ourselves. You know, we got our hot tea, and we're pouring it, but we want to talk with you, too. So join in the conversation. You can reach us and connect by dialing 503-231-8187 here on More Talk Radio on your community connection, KBLO Portland. So, I'm wondering, though, first, we campaigned so hard to get $15 minimum wage, and the only reason we have it is because of a catastrophe, you know, more or less, you know, because the truth be told, up into COVID, there were still lots of pushes here and there to get to that raise, and I don't mean to sound doom and gloom, and I know I get accused of that. I'm a realist. I look at how market forces work and how employment forces work. And, you know, the bottom line is people are going to do, and especially, you know, the robber barons, they're going to do what they're going to do. So we got this campaign going a few years ago for the $15 minimum wage. And like you said, you can't afford squat with that. When you read comments and articles, in news articles and what have you, you hear people saying, well, I don't know why people got to have $15 an hour for working at Burger Doodle. I got a master's degree. I got this, and I only make that. And, you know, as if that's the answer to why people are, you know, out here protesting and marching for more money, like it's all contingent upon how much education you have. And, you know, my answer would be, well, number one, remember the wage market is artificially depressed, and the cost of living and doing business is artificially increased. Mm-hmm. And there's this disparity, and maybe you should think about, do you really have a grasp of how much things cost and how much people should pay? And are you also being a little selfish because, you know, you think, well, I got this education, I paid for that. Maybe, however, you are worth more money yourself. You know, until the 80s, and we had both the new collar and the dot-com and tech ceiling just blow wide open with wages, mm-hmm. weren't making these kind of wages. And then suddenly you had this massive increase in wage, and it changed everything. You know, people who were in the beginning of coding and programming and what have you, or in just electronics in general, and new collar workers like couriers for companies like UPS and FedEx and some of these other jobs, caused a massive increase in salaries. And so you had this weird tier of salaries. You had people who maybe didn't have education. No, let me say this, mainstream education. That's what we should say. They were suddenly, if you didn't have those skills, you were left out, and you didn't necessarily fit. But, you know, you might have 1 year of a certificate program that taught you this particular hot tech skill, and so here you are all of a sudden earning $16-17 an hour back in the mid-80s, you know, threw everything off. And I think people have not taken that in consideration. You know, now, here's the weird thing about it, too. The generation that's the most, that has the most education, is the best education of any of our generations past here in U.S., usually carries the most debt and has the hardest time finding a job and can't get home, can't buy a home, you know. And, and that's our millennials and the Gen Zers. And so you have to wonder, what kind of economy do we have to look forward to? Because in the normal scheme of things, you know, if you look at it in a linear progression, you would expect that they would not only be wiser but richer, but they're not. You know, they're carrying more school debt. They're not. They can't get a decent wage. They can't get a job that pays 40 hours and benefits. A lot of them are doing gig economy. So, you know, you just, the question again is, are you going back to work? If you're not going back to work, what are you going to do? And what do you think of these wages? And how are we going to sustain anything that looks like functioning? I don't know if I should say normal, but a functioning economy where everybody's engaged and enfranchised. I can't be.
Yeah. How do we work in this new reality and be inclusive of all people? And maybe it's an opportunity. It's also an opportunity, I think, to for workers to find new ways, not only to find their voice, but also in terms of organizing. And I think to tip the scales in favor of workers in terms of advocating is something good. Forcing the employers to wrestle with what must I do, what must we do to get the workers that we need, and examine not only wages but benefits, working conditions. You know, one thing that many families are struggling is childcare. How is it possible to work when a lot of your income is just being forced to pay for childcare for your child, and so you don't get ahead? It also means an examination of how do we value those who provide childcare or caring for others. Are their wages one in which they can find a livable. So we have to examine a whole lot of things in terms of our society. How do we balance, you know, not only child care, but also the hours we work? Must we shift to a various different ways of working hours? Is, you know, the normal 8-to-5 shift reasonable for people? One thing with the new economy and the possibility of people working different types of hours is something that we must look into and thinking about what must we do to make it possible for people to live well enough to provide for their families and be able to not only aspire but realistically see the possibility of transforming their lives. It's a changing world, and the pause we've had for this last year and a half is a possibility for us to either create a more wholesome world for all of us, or will those who have been in control of the economy just clamp down harder and make things much more difficult for workers? What are some of your thoughts? 503-231-8187. Give us a call, share with Celeste and I, and I'm looking at Celeste on the screen, and she has this background of Rosie the Worker. Is that it, Celeste?
Yeah, that's a black woman version of it. I like messing with my screensavers, you know, and it's paying homage to the fact that we're all out here working today. You know, I also had it up kind of like as an ironic statement on Juneteenth. You know, uh-huh. I've been using a lot of the check-ins I had because it's like I'm still a couple of, you know, of my white friends were saying Happy Juneteenth, and we had an interesting conversation, you know, about it. So, you know, to ask my white friends, so you saying Happy Juneteenth, what exactly does Juneteenth mean for you? You know,
mm-hmm.
That's another conversation.
That's a whole other conversation. The rush for the states and the federal government to claim Juneteenth, and I'm saying, really?
Well, I'm thinking big damn deal. How come you didn't strike down these laws on voter suppression?
Exactly.
The new one.
Exactly. It's sort of like, it's ironic, isn't it, that there's this rush to celebrate Juneteenth. Why not pass laws to protect the right to vote? These are a whole lot of things. But we have a caller on the line, Joan, who wants to connect to, want to talk about working and connecting it with housing. So let's go to Joan.
Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Well, while you're talking about work and the economy, I don't think it's a coincidence that people are talking about, oh, the eviction moratorium is going to end, and now lots of people will be evicted, and lots of people are homeless. And I think that's a really great way to force people to go back to work, don't you? Mm-hmm. I think if people are talking about inflation, it's a little hard for me to hear you, so I'm sorry if I'm talking over you. I'm thinking that there's a connection between the real estate industry and all of this, and I think one of the things that needs to change, and something that is really majorly connected, as you're talking about inflation and people are saying, oh, the cost of groceries is going to go up. Well, the cost of housing has been astronomical and really a mess for quite a long time. And people seem to think it's normal to pay, you know, $1,500 a month for a studio apartment or something like that. It is not normal. And my feeling about it is what's happening is that as the cost of housing goes up, what's happening is that the value of the dollar is simply going down, so that your money is worth less. And this is a problem. And I think that one solution for workers, although it doesn't necessarily change the other thing, is unionization. People should be looking for good union jobs and insisting on them. And as far as the consumers are concerned, I think as long as we consider convenience to be the major factor influencing our lives, then people will continue to buy from Amazon, and people in those sad jobs will continue to be exploited. So we need to look at cooperatives. We need to look at cooperating. And when we purchase things, we need to consider where we're purchasing from.
Let me jump in here. Here's the problem with the life that we live now, because ordinarily what you're saying would make perfect sense. But I live in a neighborhood where to get to the co-op where I want to belong, I got to take two buses minimally, just two buses, and carry something on those buses. I'm not going to stop at the co-op. I'm just not, because I don't have that much time, because I'm probably also a gig worker, and I probably can only work 4 hours at a time doing whatever I'm doing. And if I can't route going to my favorite co-op where I can get healthier food into that gig work day, I'm going to shop at the, you know, the grocery store near me, even if it's a big box, because they got cheaper prices and it's just up the street from me, and it won't cost me gasoline or bus time, you know, to get there. And that's one of the realities we're facing now. What you're saying is right, but unfortunately our infrastructure has changed. And so we don't have that same. So, you know, I'm waiting on us to come up with, well, no, I'm not waiting. I'm trying to encourage and think myself. But I'm wondering how we're going to come up with some new ways of addressing the fact that this push for a global economy, a global market, and everything has changed how we can even shop. And so sometimes it's not a matter of us being lazy. It's not that we are voting against ourselves. It's just we're trying to maximize these few hours we got with the few dollars we got and get the most we can get. You know, because you're right about having co-ops.
I see you're right, and I'm sorry if I sounded judgmental, and I probably was trying to
not at all. Not at all. You don't sound judgmental. You're making sense, but things change. Like, you know,
I guess my point is that it is all connected. It is.
Yeah, you're right.
And the real estate industry is really a big part of this, and a lot of people are invested. You know, their houses, it's their only big investments, and so it's very important to them that when they retire, they can get this money back. And I'm not trying to be judgmental or to blame anyone. I think that it is a big part of the problem. And the cost of housing, when people are, you know, looking at, I'm an older person, and, you know, people are saying, oh, well, inflation, this and that, but they don't factor in the cost of housing and the cost of health care, those two things. Are really driving us and turning us into wage slaves, because without the money, you can't. You simply, I mean, it is a form of wage slavery. You're forced into this job, whatever kind of job it is, and you have to scramble and do stuff. At least we're appreciating people who do the kind of work that isn't paid well. I think that's a good thing. I'm sorry if I sounded judgmental. It's just the whole situation makes me angry, because all you have to do is walk outside and you're tripping over people who are living on the street. They're, you know, literally living on the street. And why?
Yes.
You know, some of these people are working. I know a guy who was living on the street, and he had a job in the gas station right near where he was sleeping. You know what I mean? He had a job, but there's no way that he could get a place to live. And meanwhile, people look at these people and think, gosh, I don't want that to happen to me. So now the eviction moratorium is ending, and you know there's going to be a bunch of evictions. Is that part of the? It's not like it's a conspiracy to force people back to work, but the system seems to have this kind of grinding, momentum that's
yes.
in a place where nobody wants to be. Nobody wants to be. You know, and
nice.
Yes, if somebody's doing the job of picking up your trash, then they should be paid decently. It doesn't matter what kind of education they have. And a lot of the people who are doing that work, by the way, have college degrees. I've got a college degree. People will do what they need to do, but we shouldn't have to be living this way. And the fact that people are raking it in on the cost of housing, and meanwhile people are fighting to end the eviction moratorium, and the landlords are saying, you know, no, this can't happen, the person can't pay their rent, so they're out, so they'll raise the rent and get some other person in there. It's just, well, you know, it's a rant, but we know that this is the truth, but I just felt that I would say it. Do I know what to do about it? No, but I think unionizing is a good idea. And thank you.
Yes. All right. Thank you. I think you summed it up. Go ahead, Cecil.
No, I was going to say, make an observation that one of the important points I think Joan made was in terms of unionization and how important that is. I think when certain segments or all of us think about when things were better for workers, the post-war economy, those were times when a higher percentage of the American population were in unions. And since the economy has had this collapse since around 1970, that was the time when the union rate began to fall. And as more and more Americans were no longer in unions, the wages remained stagnant, and workers were unable to meet the challenges of living. And so it is no accident, I think, that the American dream began to fade away for more and more people when the percentage of those in unions began to fall. And so I agree with Joan in her observation about how workers need to organize, and just as to make things a little bit more fairer, to organize against in an economy where things seem to be stacked against them. And so, you know, we continue to see the attempt to organize workers in this gig economy. We see the attempt to organize workers in Amazon, and workers continue to need to be organized as unions, so because our voices are only strong if we unite together. But I won't slip into a union song right now, but I think you know where I'm coming from.
Yeah. And we want to encourage your calls. You know, we can talk about this. Cecil and I will read our articles, and we'll discuss, and we'll argue when we don't agree. But we don't want to hear just ourselves. We want to hear you too. So share your thoughts, share your ideas and your opinions, and join us by dialing 503-231-8187. And share with us your experience of this. I mean, are you going back to work? Are you going back to work the job you had before?
Edie is on the line. Let's see what Edie has to say.
All righty. Good morning.
Edie is not on
okay,
the line.
Okay, there we go. Up. I think I heard somebody say someone's not on the line. Did we drop?
Well, if you're not on the line, Edie, you may give us a call back at 503-231-8187. That's the number,
yep.
Right? Okay.
That's right. I
stop rambling it off, and then I get, you know, all of a sudden my mind stops in the middle. I say, oh, is that the number, or am I giving the number to, I don't know, my doctor or, you know, my sister. So, okay, 503-231-8187. Give us a call.
So, you know, one of the other things that I'm thinking about is I've seen some of these jobs offer free training, some of them that are a little bit higher on the job fulfillment or job significance. I don't even know how you measure that scale. And I'm thinking, if I were looking for a job right now, I might take some of these folks up on it and get this education, get this training, and maybe another skill as, you know, as a way of not having to go back to the unskilled or underpaid labor force. And maybe that's what people are doing. Maybe they're thinking, I don't want to be in hospitality services anymore. I think I'll take up this job where I can learn how to be an expediter, or I can learn to drive a truck, or, you know, I can get my certified medical aid, or, you know, project manager, something job, mm-hmm. where people are going. But I'm, like we said, we're curious as to how this shift in employment is affecting you. Are you going back to work, or are you going to run your unemployment out and just hope that something meaningful comes your way? Do you have a more solid plan in effect, and you're going to work your plan? We're curious, and we got a good 12 minutes or so left. Don't make me a super talk, because we...
So one of the things that, as you were sharing, in terms of people using the opportunity they have to explore other options, it raises a question for me in terms, and we've heard some of this discussion among politicians have raised the issue, and certainly since the pandemic, of a guaranteed annual income, maybe $1,000 a month. And I think
Andrew used to say that all the time. Wasn't Andrew Yang proposing that quite a while ago, and even up to now?
And he's running for mayor of New York City right now. But yeah, that was something he proposed when he was running for president. And one of the things that has occurred, as you suggest, is that people with a little breathing room are able to explore what are their other options. Maybe I can spend time, you know, training for this thing that I really want to do. But, you know, I can't afford to do it because I have to pay these bills. But if there's an annual guaranteed annual income, that may give people an option to explore. And that would be good for all of us. So it's interesting how how these ideas begin as, you know, seem to be very extreme, and slowly they become part of the mainstream conversation. In the last presidential election, you had one candidate who quite clearly stated, you know, let's talk about a guaranteed annual income for all people. And I think we will continue to see these ideas that at some point seem radical and out, you know, extreme, become more mainstream, you know, like Social Security, like healthcare, and maybe housing could be seen at some point in time as a right, part of what all people should be able to have.
Well, you know, I am one of these people who celebrate the idea of housing is a right, and I know there's a whole lot of dynamic tension between, you know, individuals who have worked hard at these jobs, which are blue collar jobs, and they finally get a house, and maybe they get an opportunity to keep another piece of property in their rental property, and so they're not really high level landlords, they're just your average person. And I know there's challenges for some of them because they feel like, well, I worked hard to get this property, I scrimped and saved, so I have somebody in here living who can't pay the rent. What do I do? Because that house that I got was my guarantee that I was not going to have to work in my 80s. You know? And so I'm thinking what we need to do is change our legislation so that there is a different way that regular housing for people, you know, and small level landlords can work better together, because they're small business owners, and there's an artificial separation, an artificial dichotomy or polarization of the small person. Like if, for example, I own two houses and I rented out one, I'm not some big corporation that's, you know, turning out people. I need that mortgage payment paid. And I think we need to rethink, how we approach those type of realtors when it comes to looking at housing as a right, because housing is a need, and therefore it shouldn't be commodified the same way, you know, as the latest pair of tennis shoes. You know, but you create this polarization between the lower level real estate people and those who need housing. But we're not talking about that. That's the main conversation, I think, that needs to change.
We have about 10 minutes, and James is on the line. Let's get James in.
Good morning, James.
How are you? Can you hear me?
Doing well. Yourself? Yes, we can.
Okay, good morning. You know, I have had the, I had my job has not been affected by the pandemic, so I've been pretty much working the entire time. But, you know, in this time, I've certainly had a lot of time to reflect, you know, and I think the one thing that what I see everybody realizing is that there's a way to do things that doesn't require burnout. You know, lots of people are, you know, talking about how upset they are that, you know, it's like people took this time during the pandemic to downsize and even move out of their houses and doing their job remotely on the road because they can, you know, and realizing how much of these institutions that we work for, you know, they need our hot body. They need to control like where our bodies are at all times.
Yeah,
I'm picking up this book called The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. I'm going to be reading soon. It's Shoshana Zuboff. I've been listening to her, and basically, you know, like talking about how in this next century, how it's, you know, how, you know, like we've basically allotted our privacy to, you know, these large corporations who, you know, they sell not just our data, but like our, just like all the little stuff that we don't even realize is useful to them as a way to track us and to keep an eye on us. And I think that, you know, especially right now, you know, we need to not just be thinking about unionizing, which I think is a good idea, but we need to think past unionization as well. Like because the biggest problem that happened with the reforms over 100 years ago is that they weren't codified you know. And so ever since the New Deal, the corporations that got you know, shafted, for lack of a better word, by FDR, because he told them, you know, hey, look, you're going to pay for this stuff or we're going to get revolution, is, you know, they've been just pissy about it ever since. And so without any sort of meaningful way to move beyond just reforms, they were able to recapture it, and now they're doing us even dirtier. And so while I like the talk of unionization, we also need to not be satiated by unionization, you know, especially for black and brown folks, because, you know, the history of, you know, white-led unions is pretty awful, considering how, you know, how they used us to bolster their numbers. But then when it came time to give us what they owed us, you know, they kicked us out. You know, and maybe that's not true of every single union, but that has been the experience with pretty much all unions. And I think that that's what to realize, you know, and that's, you know, a lot of the divide that I see in a lot of, you know, socialist circles, is that, you know, they talk about how, you know, critical race theory divides the working class. And it's like, no, the critical race theory, it examines the working class and how the dynamics between, you know, settler workers and neo-colonial workers are completely different, you know. And, you know, and I think that that's what we need to be realizing, is that, you know, we as black and brown people hold so many of, we literally hold up the world, not just here in the United States, but all of our brothers and sisters of the global South. You know, they make us feel like we're inferior and that we're the ones who should be doing all the work for them. But they don't realize that if we walked out of our jobs right now, a lot of these places would be screwed. You know, even the Scandinavian models of socialism that like to be held up as opposed to the global South versions of socialism, even those would be frozen in place, because so much of the global North is dependent upon our labor and our acquiescence of inferiority. So,
well, before making good points, but hold up a minute. I want to get the name of that book again.
It's called Age of Surveillance Capitalism.
Age of Surveillance Capitalism. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And it's Shoshana Zuboff.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
we're hitting a lot of points. I agree with you with regard to the union issue. It's not just unionization. It's actually both strengthening them and holding them accountable for the way they don't protect workers of color and women, but also just rethinking how we need to get together. Now, in this book, and we only got a few more seconds, but how does the book put forth how we can take this quantum step?
Well, really what it's talking about is, you know, we really have to start thinking about organizing ourselves in a mass movement away from, essentially, like, away, we have to start pulling ourselves away from these, you know, large conglomerates who soak up our information. Like, so much of the traffic on the internet is owned by Facebook and Google, and everybody knows somebody who Facebooks or has Google email addresses. So, I mean, you know, we can start, you know, personally, we can start talking about VPNs, but, you know, that there has to be more infrastructure outside of Google that has to be allotted to grow. But that's really hard because Google lobbies so much of the government, you know. So, I mean, obviously getting, you know, corporate money out of politics is another thing, but it's realizing that, you know, this net we're caught in is a lot more complicated than we realize, but we're not paying attention to it because we're too busy being entertained. And even in the circles of what we're talking about with, you know, with regards to, you know, like socialism and unionization, even that's a lot of entertainment, because so much of the conversation is driven by white socialists. You know, like when we start talking about, like, you know, like our, you know, Kwame Nkrumah, we start talking about Franz Fanon, we start talking about, you know, Ho Chi Minh, people who have made successful, huge, even Mao, you know, he we get this blowback that is like, well, how dare you talk about that? It's because even within our own circles, we're still besieged, at least on our level, by this white ghost that just sits on our shoulder. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. The way I look at it is that as black and brown folks, I believe in reforms on the way to revolution, but we need to start looking at, and it doesn't, and when you say revolution, it doesn't happen. It's saying that, we have to look beyond, revolution means, complete turnaround. We gotta start thinking bigger, because they've already seen us at reform, and it took them 50 years to do it, but they undid it. So we need to start thinking bigger. If it's people who are really interested in real systems, we gotta think bigger. And
okay,
I know
well,
that's
we,
kind
we're
of a lot.
We're out of time, James. We're out of time, but you made some great points. So the book is The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, and you want to check it out, Shoshana Zuboff. This has been More Talk Radio with Cecil Prescott, myself, Celeste Carey. We join you in enjoying our community connection, KBOO Portland. Hope you get that T-shirt. Get one. Support us if you love what we say, or even if you just love to hate us. At KBOO.FM Give. And we will hear you next week on More Talk Radio. Bye-bye.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Also heard at Translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM, and Translator K282BH in Fallon.